The forest has plenty of metaphorical meanings in Shakespeare's plays, but his depictions of the natural world also speak to very real concerns about the environment in early modern England. From the Folger Shakespeare Library, this is Shakespeare Unlimited. I'm Michael Whitmore, the Folger director. There were no environmentalists in Shakespeare's day. That's because the science and politics that created the modern environmental movement would take another 300 years to come together. But that doesn't mean that arguments over land use and wildlife conservation weren't raging in Shakespeare's day. Todd Andrew Borlick argues in his book, Shakespeare Beyond the Green World, that King James took a particular interest in those arguments, in part because he was an avid hunter. And since Shakespeare was attuned to the interests of the king, those conflicts show up in the plays Shakespeare wrote during James's reign. Seen in this light, the plays address debates over the enclosure of land, wildlife management, overfishing, and the fur trade, sometimes in ways that serve the king's interests and sometimes subverting them. Here's Todd Andrew Borlick in conversation with Barbara Bogave.
Thinking as I started your book that it is natural to think that Renaissance England was a less polluted place than today's world, not plagued by the same environmental issues we face. But that's not entirely true at all. Well, why don't you start with a snapshot of what they were dealing with back then?
Yeah, sadly, Shakespeare's England was dealing with a lot of the same issues that we're confronting today. Climate change, overpopulation, dewilding and extinction. There's a lot of habitat destruction that's been going on really for centuries. So Shakespeare's contemporaries didn't see themselves as sort of basking in this prelapsarian, pristine environment. They saw themselves as living in an Iron Age where industrial technologies have been ravaging the planet for millennia.
Yeah, and you put a really fine point on that really the Industrial Revolution started with the Romans' arrival in Britain and their tin mining.
Yeah, that's right. There's a major expansion of mining operations in Shakespeare's day, and part motivated by the fact they're running out of wood. So there's a shift in the energy regime in the late 16th century away from an economy that's powered by wood towards coal. And you can see the origins of the Industrial Revolution are really stretched back to the late 16th century, to the Elizabethan period. And it's this that permits England to be the launch point for the Industrial Revolution. It had developed the infrastructure to harvest all of its mineral resources and created this very extractive-based economy that created the world we live in now.
And we've talked a lot on the show about the population surge that was happening right then, fourfold, you point out. And part of the conflicts at the time involved the enclosure of common lands policy that forced more people to flock to London.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's difficult for us to imagine how small London was back in the start of the 16th century. And Shakespeare's day, the population's still only around 200,000. So I mean, that's the size of Akron, Ohio today. So it's a much smaller place, but it's exploded exponentially throughout Queen Elizabeth's reign, in part because of the enclosures that are happening around the countryside. There's no longer this common land available for people to graze and do the subsistence farming. So they're forced to migrate into London to look for work. There's this urban population boom, and that creates a lot of environmental problems in terms of the coal pollution and the sanitation. So there's pollution in the Thames, and there's also plague outbreaks as a result.
Right. And to top it all off, you write that this was a time that was also a little ice age that brought cooler temperatures and bad harvests. So you have famines, you have plagues, all of this, you write, was very much top of mind for Shakespeare. And also, King James became patron of the Kingsmen in 1603. And why don't you remind us just how much James's rule involved environmental policy and these ecological issues, not only the ones we were talking about, but also because James was big on hunting and the outdoors and also an empire builder.
King James is kind of an implied spectator for a lot of Shakespeare's plays. And he is an avid outdoorsman, someone who's really deeply concerned about the state of Britain's wildlife. He grows up in Scotland, of course, and when he comes down to England, he realizes how dewilded the landscape is. There aren't as many animals around for him to hunt, and so he's quite appalled by this and is pushing a lot of legislation to promote what we would call wildlife conservation. In fact, he's even pushing what we would call rewilding initiatives, importing wild boar from France to release in Windsor Forest. So he's very ecologically savvy, but in a strange way, he's promoting these environmental conservation initiatives so he can have the prerogative of killing the animals. That's a great example of how kooky the environmentalism is of the 16th, 17th century. It doesn't quite map onto our current thinking on these issues today.
Yeah, kooky is the word. And you also say, obviously, not everyone shared James's vision of either this kind of green England or of a homogenous British empire. So what were the conflicts? Who was on what side? And how did Shakespeare explore these disputes in the plays?
Right. So the accession of King James makes Shakespeare a lot more appreciative of the wildness of Great Britain. And I think a lot of the vitality and the primal energy of Shakespeare's poetry is actually feeding off of the wildness of a pre-industrial Britain. But he's also trying to chart the topographies, the bioregional diversity of Great Britain. And that's why he's taking these extended detours in his plays to the heaths of Scotland, to the mountains of Wales, to the fens of East Anglia and Lincolnshire. There's a lot of controversy in Shakespeare's day about who really has control of the resources or who does the land belong to. James obviously fancied himself an absolute monarch and thought that this was, his candy store, really. And a lot of the courtiers are constantly jockeying for these monopolies and patents to exploit the natural resources of the land.
One sentence in your introduction of these themes really leapt out at me, and you wrote, "His plays present a commoner's eye view on an absolute monarch's eye view of the natural world, and the gulf between these perspectives shapes what stories he tells and how he tells them." So I read that. What I heard there is you saying Shakespeare wasn't just a court eco-propagandist. I mean, he was laying out these issues. And for instance, as you mentioned, it does put a different spin on Lear. As you describe it, you see the play as a blow to ecological tyranny. Unpack that for us.
All right. So James had written about himself as this absolute monarch who had a God-given right to all the resources of the land. And this rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And I think the hubris of James's attitudes towards the environment, that it was his personal dominion, creates a corresponding backlash in Shakespeare where he starts to critique these ideas of environmental sovereignty. Sort of corrode some of the hubris of James's delusions. So there's, in many of the late plays, a trope that I call the king in the storm. So you have this very privileged ruler who makes these grandiose claims to environmental sovereignty, and they wander out into these wild spaces and are disabused of these cornucopian selfish delusions that the land exists to cater to them.
Hmm. Let's talk about heaths, because I realized when I started your book, I didn't even know what a heath was. But let's talk about it, in specific, in Macbeth. And the blasted heath Shakespeare depicts is an abode for witches. And now often we're taught that's Shakespeare catering to the Scottish King James obsession with witches and witchcraft. But you say it goes far beyond that, particularly if you look at Scotland and land policy. there at the time. So explain that connection.
So the heath is a man-made landscape that's the result of deforestation, where the soil could not regenerate the trees, or humans have been grazing it so the trees can't return. So it's full of this vegetation like heather, ling, firs, gorse. For most people in Shakespeare's day, it's a wasteland. But the attitudes towards it are really changing. There's a movement to scorch them and convert them into arable farmland. The commoners, the landless poor, really reliant on the heaths for subsistence farming and for grazing. But it's these wealthy landowners who are coming in, torching the heath, or blasting it, as I say, and trying to convert it to agriculture. So Shakespeare's description of it as blasted suggests that it's, you know, infected by some kind of supernatural agency, but it might also refer to the actual practice of burning or scorching the heaths by agricultural improvers. So a lot of these agricultural improvers, we would call them developers today, have very pejorative views of the heaths as these abodes of witchcraft and sterility. Some of that registers clearly in Shakespeare's Macbeth. But James also had a deep appreciation for heaths because they are bastions for wildlife. James is constantly escaping London to go to his hunting lodges to spend time on the heaths. And he's concerned, again, that people are poaching there, that they're destroying the heathlands, they're nest robbing. This is really infused into the imagery of Shakespeare's Macbeth. It's not just the description of the blasted heath, but there's all these avian images throughout the play, too, where Shakespeare seems to be endorsing the conservation policies of the king.
And you write that this was deliberate on Shakespeare's part, and you see that because he's departing from his source, Holinshed, who described Macbeth and Banquo passing through woods and fields, not a blasted heath.
Yes. Yeah, so it's as almost as if Shakespeare's kind of fast-forwarded history from this medieval era where there's just a clearing where the original encounter takes place with the Weird Sisters to a blasted heath. Because these clearings over the centuries, as the land's deforested, will turn into heaths. So he seems to be aware of the heathification of the Scottish landscape, and it's something that humans did. It's not something that's just naturally occurring.
Huh. And now we get to the birds. Mm. Shakespeare compares Macbeth to a poacher and a kite, and you write that. You point out that's a species considered vermin. Macbeth is imagining a red kite devouring human corpses. Our monuments shall be the maws of kites. So how does this ecological preservation theme explain the birds as a motif in the play?
So it's curious that the avian imagery is so consistent throughout the play. It's more prevalent than we've realized. In one of the earliest accounts of a performance of the play, Simon Forman writes the name of Macduff as Macdove. And in Holinshed, the Duncan character is actually known as Duff. Now, Duff is a Scottish pronunciation of dove. So there's this real dichotomy in the play between birds that are seen as positive, beneficial to humans, and then birds that are seen as vermin, as predatorial. So this divide between the forces of sterility and ferility in the play out in the avian images. And this reflects actual environmental policy in 16th, 17th century, where certain species who were declared non grata were actually hunted. There was a bounty on them. And kites and ravens and crows were all killed in huge numbers. And it led to the decimation of a lot of England's wildlife.
Okay, so Macbeth's killing of Duncan and Macduff then is kind of an allegory for what is illegal hunting and I think you write nest robbing and raiding of estate buildings known as dovecotes.
Yeah, exactly, Barbara. So there's a scene in Act 1, Scene 7, I think. Macbeth speaks about trammeling up the consequences of his crime. A trammel is actually a type of net that was used by birders out on the heaths, and King James has outlawed these. So Macbeth is violating the king's own environmental policies. And then there's all this avian imagery in the scene associated with Macduff, or Macdove, as I've come to think of him. And the attack on his castle is replicating a raid on a dovecote. And this was commonly done in the 17th century by the king's own men who were looking for saltpeter. They're harvesting the droppings to make gunpowder. And dovecotes were flashpoints for environmental law, because these were places where the king had claimed that he owned the land, he owned all the soil of the realm, and these gunpowder men or saltpeter men are bursting in, killing the doves, digging up the land. And Shakespeare replicates that in that scene when the murderers kill Macduff's family. And there's even an indication of nest robbing. One of the weirdest lines probably in all of Shakespeare is when one of the murderers says before he stabs Macduff's son is, "What, you egg?" And I think that's
exceptional. I never got that. That was just a little kid.
Yeah. So it's such a bizarre line that a lot of productions cut it out because it makes people laugh at an awkward moment. But Shakespeare's really collapsing the animal-human boundary with metaphors like that.
Okay. So just to help us out, in the end, what does Macbeth sum up about Britain's environmental divide at the time? Oof. I know that's a hard one, but I'm anticipating you're going to say it's like many of Shakespeare's plays, if not all of them. He has it both ways.
That's part of the beauty of Shakespeare's works, isn't it? That capaciousness, that ability to see both points of view. And on the one hand, he is supporting King James's policies, and he is supporting this agrarian attitude of developing the land and promoting human control over the landscape through agriculture. But at the same time, I think there's a dark ecology to the play as well, that Shakespeare is exalting the heaths, that his poetry is really energized and inflamed by the wildness of nature, by the predatorial species, the violence, the drama of wildness. And so he's exalting the darker side of nature. So we partially sort of root for Macbeth, and we're saddened by his loss because it also is replicating the destruction of the wildness of England, the kites, the ravens, the wolves that are being gradually rubbed out of the picture.
Let's tackle Pericles next. And before I ask you my questions, maybe you could remind us of the plot, because it's not the most often staged of Shakespeare's plays.
It's not the most streamlined plot either, is it?
I know. It's not fair. Better you than me.
it zigzags all over the place. At the heart of it, it's about Pericles' attempt to recover his family, and as a result of the storm at sea. His wife gives birth in the midst of a sea storm. She apparently dies, so she's hurled overboard because it's bad luck to keep a corpse on board. The sailors are very superstitious. He leaves the newborn daughter on the coast with a foster family who are supposed to look after the daughter, but in fact they get quite annoyed with how wonderful and impossibly, you know, good-looking and clever she is. So they decide, the evil queen decides to have her kidnapped. So she's sold into slavery, and she's taken to a whorehouse. She's essentially destined to become a sex slave. But through her eloquence and her supernatural charm, she manages to just overawe everyone with her goodness. And Pericles travels around the Mediterranean as a broken man, and is eventually reunited with his wife and daughter.
Okay, good. The play is coming back to us, I hope. And now we can talk about fish instead of the birds. So here you write that Shakespeare's working with European battles over fishing rights. So what was the dispute all about?
Well, this is a great example of the way that history constantly rhymes. One of the driving forces behind Brexit, as many listeners will know, was the desire of the British fishing industry to wriggle out of the regulations of the EU. And there are similar squabbles going on over the fisheries in the 17th century. So King James is trying to claim national ownership of the fisheries and exclude other nations from coming in and harvesting the fish. And he's driven to do this because the fisheries are collapsing already. There's already a sense that fishing has been done in an unsustainable way that's driven the shoals farther and farther from shore. And there's a real concern that the fish are disappearing. And Shakespeare is glancing at this in Pericles when he talks about the watery empire of Pericles and includes a scene where the fishermen are complaining that the fish are being gobbled up. The big fish are gobbling up the little ones in the way that the wealthy are devouring the poor. And this is playing out actually in the fisheries as well, and the way that they're being over-harvested.
So this maybe is a dumb question, but is there reason to believe Shakespeare was just conversant in the debate about British sea sovereignty?
Well, keep in mind, he's working for the king. The king's his patron. So he has an ear on a lot of the discussions, the debates, the economic policies of the court. And he's writing plays that are trying to entertain people who are steeped in this and are writing the rule book, devising the legislation. So, of course, he's weaving these allusions into the play to entice them, to startle them, to shock them, and often force them to reevaluate, reassess their ideologies, their policies.
Okay. Another part of your argument is that Pericles also deals with fears of coastal erosion.
Yes. So, in 1607, one of the worst natural disasters occurs in the history of England. There's this massive tidal bore that comes up the Severn, and it's so intense, some scientists have proposed it could even have been a tsunami. The tidal wave is probably 12 feet high, and it seems to have inundated villages 14 miles inland. There are several allusions in the play to the sea swallowing the land. So there's this irony in the play in that Pericles and King James are both claiming sovereignty of the sea as if it's their private possession. But what we see in reality is that the sea is gnawing away at the land, is destroying their kingdom, it's eroding it. There's this fear of coastal erosion, of coastal change in Shakespeare's day that's as pronounced as our fear of climate change. England was getting smaller.
Okay, there are so many layers here, too. Now moving on to The Winter's Tale, and here you write the Tudor environmental conflict involves the inhumanity of the fur trade. So first, again, just very briefly, if you could remind us of the plot of The Winter's Tale, since it's another lesser-known play.
Yeah, so King Leontes is overcome with this irrational jealousy that he believes his best friend, Polixenes, is having an affair with his wife, Hermione. So he flies into a jealous rage. When Hermione gives birth, he banishes the child into the wilderness. He has Hermione tried for treason. And 16 years pass before he is eventually reunited with his lost daughter, who's grown up on a farm in the countryside of Bohemia. She returns home, is reunited with him, and then he goes to the art gallery of Paulina, and the statue of his dead wife is miraculously resurrected. So once again, we have this plot with the separation and reunion of the family as really core to Shakespeare's late romances.
And where do we get the inhumanity of the fur trade in this?
Well, this is the play that contains the most famous stage direction in all of Shakespeare, Exit Pursued by a Bear. In 1609, a man named Jonas Poole makes a voyage to Bear Island in Svalbard, and he kills and skins seven polar bears. One of the bears he kills has two young cubs that he says are about the size of newborn lambs, and he brings them back to London and gives them to King James. And it's quite possible that one of these polar bears could have been imprinted on a handler and trained to perform. And it's not inconceivable that in a court performance of The Winter's Tale that a polar bear may have actually scampered across the stage. The polar bear's white fur is a signifier of luxury, of the wealth to be gained in the Arctic fur trade. And there's imagery of skinning and flaying all throughout the play. This is really pronounced in the pun on the name of the queen, Hermione. I was reading a Elizabethan romance called Sidney's Arcadia, and I noticed there's a scene where these two knights are quarreling, and there's an impressa on one of the knight's shields of an ermine. But Sidney spells it E-R-M-I-O-N, ermine, and it is almost... fell out of my chair when I realized that, in fact, Hermione is imagined as an ermine. And there's several reasons for this. The ermine is from the snowy north. It's a member of the weasel family, and it's seasonally dimorphic, which means that its coat changes white in winter. They're imported from Russia. They are symbols of royalty. Only the monarch is allowed to wear ermine. And they're also symbols of sexual chastity. The one thing people knew about ermine in Shakespeare's day is that it would rather be killed than sully its lustrous white coat.
Which is what Queen Hermione says.
Yes.
She'd rather die than stain her name as an adulteress.
Exactly. So it seems as if Leontes is conducting this really sadistic experiment where he wants Hermione to prove her sexual fidelity by dying. She has to reenact the feat of her namesake, the ermine. And it's not just the spelling, but what I was shocked to discover is that if you scan the meter of the play, maybe we've been mispronouncing it for 400 years. We all say Hermione, but if you look at the lines, he's beat from his best ward, well said, ermine, and leave you to your graver steps, ermine. Thou art ermine, or rather thou art she. Those are 10-syllable lines. If you say Hermione, you've got 12-syllable lines. It's as if the king's using a pet name for his wife to constantly badger her to live up to this impossible ideal of sexual chastity.
So you're saying the audience in Shakespeare's day would know exactly what was going on?
Yes, they would have twigged onto this for sure, because they're so attuned to clothing as markers of status. And when she's accused of infidelity in the treason trial, she would be stripped of her fur on stage because only the queen can wear that. And so the trial scene, it reenacts the flaying of an ermine.
But you're not saying that Shakespeare's putting forth agendas against animal cruelty or had any even such ideas about that. I mean, he's a glover's son. He dealt with animal skins. He probably wore fur. What's the conflict here?
As you said before, Barbara, I think he has it both ways. This is what makes him so beguiling. Yes, Shakespeare's almost certainly wearing furs himself in winter. He knows that this is accepted part of English culture. But I think the imaginative range of Shakespeare, his capacity to empathize across not just lines of gender and race, but also species, is really superhuman. It's one of the most extraordinary things about him, and it's what makes his plays so phenomenally moving. So there's an aspect of him that is deeply upset and moved by the mistreatment of other species and of the planet, even as he knows to some extent that it's inevitable.
Do you see a shift in how Shakespeare thought about these issues during his lifetime as he aged?
One of the ideas I put forward in the book is that James's reign creates a shift towards thinking about Britain as a much wilder place. In the Elizabethan plays, Shakespeare is mostly confined to lowland England and the forests and pastures. After James comes to the throne, he is venturing out into heaths and mountains and fens. It's as if he's trying to chart that topographical diversity of the realm. So I do think he's much more invested in environmental issues in his later plays because his patron King James was.
I'm still thinking about what you were just saying about The Winter's Tale. And it's almost as if you're suggesting that Shakespeare was or his plays are a little bit like early canaries in the coal mine of our modern ecological degradation.
Yeah, that's
is that overstating it?
No, I quite like that metaphor, actually. He is forcing us to think about the way that we treat the earth, the way that we assume that the natural resources are just there for our plucking. You can see that his plays are extrapolating out what happens if we behave in this way indefinitely, all right, for generations, if we are constantly taking from the earth and not giving back. I think some of the apocalyptic anxiety in plays like King Lear and Timon of Athens and Macbeth are registering a sense that this covenant with nature has been broken, that nature might stop catering to our survival.
Hmm. Oh, I was thinking you did a lot of research for this book, including hiking a good bit in Great Britain. Any memorable things happened during your trip?
I did go on a quest in the Finlands to try to track down Tidymun. This is a spirit of the wetlands. I've come to kind of think of him as the Lorax of the Finns. So I went with a colleague of mine who's a wonderful poet and a great naturalist, Stevie Lai, and he's from this part of the country. And we went off to a pub, and we were trying to talk to the locals to figure out if, you know, they knew anything about Tidymun. And maybe secretly I was hoping we would kind of stumble into the Wicker Man and we'd uncover this pagan cult that had been, you know, flourishing underground for centuries. But the, you know, the locals at the pub just looked at me blankly like I was a lunatic. I had another strange encounter when I hiked up Pendle Hill, which was the site of a famous Jacobean witch trial. When I got to the top, there was a woman wearing a black witch hat. And I walked up to her and I said, "Oh, I was hoping I would find a witch today." And she turned around and looked at me and said, "They're still here. Their bones are all in the ground." And I backed away slowly at that point.
You didn't swing a dead cat or anything?
That would have been a good idea.
Well, the book is so interesting. Thank you. Thanks for that. And thanks for this. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Barbara. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
That was Todd Andrew Borlick talking to Barbara Bogave. Shakespeare, Beyond the Green World, Drama in Eco-Politics in Jacobean Britain is out now from Oxford University Press. This episode was produced by Matt Frassica with help from Kendra Hanna. Garland Scott is the associate producer. It was edited by Gail Kern Pastor. Ben Lauer is the web producer with help from Leonor Fernandez. We had technical help from Voice Tracks West in Studio City, California. Final mixing services provided by Clean Cuts at 3Cs Inc. If you're a fan of Shakespeare Unlimited, please leave us a review on your podcast platform of choice to help others find the show. Shakespeare Unlimited comes to you from the Folger Shakespeare Library. Home to the world's largest Shakespeare collection, the Folger is dedicated to advancing knowledge in the arts. Our building in Washington, D.C. has been under construction for the past 4 years, but we're looking forward to fully reopening on June 21st, 2024. You can find out more about the Folger at our website, folger.edu. Thanks for listening. For the Folger Shakespeare Library, I'm Folger Director Michael Whitmore.